What's the name of the podcast?
What are we calling the podcast? We still don't know.
Hello, Dogtown!
Check it, check it, check it. What's up, everyone? You're now tuned into Dogtown. Hello, Dogtown. And today we have a very, very interesting topic, something that's current, you know, and we all have heard of the term gentrification. And, you know, we have one of our friends here who is going through the current process of gentrification in Inglewood. He lives right across from the stadium, the new Los Angeles Rams stadium. And he's just going to tell us about what's going on right now. So my name's Nathaniel, and I'm gonna let Robin, you know, introduce what first gentrification is.
Well, should we first check in with everyone and see how everyone's doing? Introduce everyone's table. It's Robin here. Hello, Dogtown.
Hello, everybody. It's Helen.
Hey, everyone. It's Scott.
Trevion D. Beck reporting for duty.
Trevion D. Beck reporting for duty.
I love that one.
You got a project? Oh, okay. So Helen needs to work on her project.
Mandatory.
Yeah, do it.
It's a mandatory assignment.
If you want to hop in whenever,
so she's
then
excused.
You can.
She's
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay.
Pass that mic to Trevion.
Trevion D. Beck, reporting for duty. You've been reporting for duty before here, right? This is a familiar voice, a familiar face, a familiar...
Too bad you can't...
Partner on this project and generally in SPY. We're excited to have you here formally as our guest, I guess, and lead discussion person.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys portraying me in such a positive way. I just try to be the best version of me possible, you know? But yeah, are you guys ready to, how are we doing it? You guys ready to?
First, yeah, so we're going to have like Robin tell you what, like tell us what gentrification means. And then I guess, you know, then Trevion, you know, we're just going to ask you a lot of questions about what's your experience like.
Okay. So I was just saying before we turn on the mic that gentrification is something that we hear a lot about. I think often, especially here in Los Angeles, but most cities, major cities across the country, it's something we see, we know is happening, we can feel it, we can often see when it's happened, but less so often do we feel it always when it's happening or acknowledge when it's ongoing in the process or the beginning process. But also, I think sometimes it's hard to even put a specific definition onto it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Does anyone want to guess before I say the Wikipedia or dictionary definition of gentrification?
I don't know. My own personal experience with the word and just how I feel from it, it's kind of like my own biased definition of it, but I'm pretty sure it hits like a mutual agreeing point that most people can agree what the definition is. So for me, it's when either the city, private property owners, or people with a lot of money take it upon themselves to buy out a lot of property in the area, almost monopoly status, where they have the ability to buy out almost everything and then no one else can compete with them. And then they build this up to such a high degree, usually in the entertainment industry, to where it attracts lots of people to the surrounding area, thus making it... you know, increasingly more difficult for other people to live there as far as like the rent and things being affordable, because now the area looks nicer. So you have an area that doesn't look nice and then it gets built up really nice, has airports and stuff like that. So now they're saying, oh, okay, well, rent was $800, but because we have all these fancy things we just built and you now have access to as a community member, now your rent should be from $800 to now like $1,300. So, you know, it significantly increases rent and the pricings of things in an area based on a company or organization buying out a lot of property and increasing the value of the area.
Comment.
No, I mean, that's pretty thorough definition. Trevion's very own.
Yeah.
What about?
I think for me, what one of the big things that led me into activism around homelessness was realizing that I was a gentrifier in Koreatown. I moved into the Vermont and Beverly area near the subway in 2000, and the apartment was $500. That's why I moved in, because it was cheap, right? Neighborhood disinvestment, like you were talking about, right? Before the folks with money come in, there's purposeful, right? Bank disinvestment and, you know, refusing to give business loans to people in certain neighborhoods and things like that. And I watched as I like started talking to the folks that were sleeping outside in the neighborhood, and the things that were happening to them and the ways that they kind of explained to me who I was as like a queer person moving into the neighborhood. And they said, watch, within less than 10 years, you're going to start to see other white folks moving in. Now, the whole building next door, all of the immigrant families that were living in the building next door to the one that I was living in 2008, they all have been displaced. And it's all white folks living in that neighborhood. But it's like, I think that needs to be addressed too, that those of us that are, you know, white, that are looking for affordable neighborhoods, right? We go into these neighborhoods. I wasn't from LA. I was from a tiny town. Gentrification hadn't happened in my hometown at that point, right? And just kind of acknowledging that, like, we all play a role in it. It's not just big business. And sometimes, you know, when we move into that neighborhood as, you know, allies and people who want to, like, be aware of gentrification, like you said, like, what are the solutions to it, right?
Yeah.
Nathaniel, like, yeah. It's not just complaining about it. It's like, what do we do about it? And it turned me into an activist.
Exactly. I mean, that's great, because too many times we hear people always just complaining about gentrification, you know, and then it's, you know, one of those hot topics people just talk about. And, you know, that's why we need to start, you know, expecting real solutions from our politicians, you know, because they're not bringing up actual solutions. They're just talking about it. And so, you know, I like how you, you know, took it from just talking about it and actually started becoming an activist for it. For me, like, it's just like the big part of gentrification, what I see is just it destroys identity of a group of people, because when they're kicked out of a certain, you know, area without a certain plan put in place to where they can go or whatever, you know, they're kind of like left to like scatter, you know, and figure it out for themselves. And then they're being spread out throughout the whole city into areas that they don't know, people that they don't know, and you know, cultures that they don't understand. So it's like, you're not just having to move somewhere, you know, but you're also having to, you know, relearn a whole different culture, this and that, which leaves you at a disadvantage. And so that, you know, that's, for me, gentrification, the biggest part is just the destruction of identity.
Yeah, that's, so I'm going to read the two definitions that we pulled up here. So one, it's gentrification is a process of changing the character of a neighborhood through the influx of more affluent residents and businesses. But basically the process of renovating or improving a house or a district so it conforms to middle class taste. So both of these things have two things in the definition that's common. It's a process, right? Which I think is really interesting about it. So something, gentrification is something that happens, right? To neighborhoods, and specifically about conforming and improving to improving with
to a certain group of people,
you know, with quotation like marks on the, around the
perspective or perception of what improvement is, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. So let's talk about, Trevian, so we're going to talk about Inglewood specifically. How long have you, when did you arrive in Inglewood? Tell us, who are you?
I first arrived in Inglewood around like 2.5, almost 3 years ago, probably like early, like, late like 2016, early 2017 is when I got in there. And Safe Place for Youth had helped me get associated with PATH, or People Assisting the Homeless. And they had showed me three different apartments, and Inglewood being the closest one to Safe Place for Youth at the time, with the cheapest rent, is the why I chose that one. So I got housed there.
So how long have you been coming to SPY, just to give us context? I feel like I've known you for a while. You've been a member here for a long time and really like an important part of SPY, in my opinion.
I've been coming here a little bit longer than when I got housed in Inglewood. So I've been a SPY for like 3 years, or a little bit more than that. So like a little more, just, yeah, about 3 years or more.
Tell us.
So, yeah.
Tell us about your connection to SPY, I guess.
Oh, my connection to SPY actually stems it. Well, it stems from my Japanese professor, because when I was going through my homelessness, my Japanese professor, I asked Ms. Iwa, was one of the first people who talked to me and said she would look up youth resources and found Safe Place for Youth. So that's how I first got connected. And then obviously by taking advantage of the resources and the different programs and stuff like that, I worked my way up through the Safe Place for Youth and just kind of became a well-known member by constantly giving back to the community and putting in a lot of community work. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I got interconnected, right? Teaching Tai Chi and stuff like that, or gardening to people here, or yeah. So like a lot of mindfulness and gardening, and also just helping out, going to a lot of the community events and stuff like that, just participating.
Yeah.
So before you moved to Inglewood, where were you living before your homeless experience?
Like before I was homeless at all? Yeah. I was living in Culver City. Yes, yes.
So not even that far from here or even Inglewood.
Yep.
What do you think, like, because it sounds like you've lived there for a couple of years. What do you think of Inglewood? Do you enjoy being there? Is it a nice place to live, like, before the gentrification, like, really took hold?
Yeah, so Inglewood is a nice place to live, I would say, before the gentrification and even after it, because it's just a nice area in general. People aren't messing with you too much. Like, people there just kind of typically mind their own business. So you're not, unless you're looking for, like, deep trouble, you don't really get into trouble over there like that. So, yeah, it's definitely a nice place to live and, like, to kind of start building yourself up. And it's still not too far from all the areas where you would want to work from. So it's definitely good in that regards. But after the gentrification, I guess the only way it wouldn't look negative, as in you wouldn't want to live there now, is because everything's so high. They, like, literally just redid so many apartments, mm-hmm. like, within the 2-year span.
Well, my question is about, so you got connected to PATH through SPY. Mm-hmm. And PATH is a housing service center here on the west side, but also kind of all over LA, right?
Mm-hmm.
And were these rapid rehousing? Was this a rapid rehousing program or a different type of program?
Yes, it was like a rapid rehousing type of program where they just help you get housed, and they have, like, they're supposed to have permanent supportive housing services and stuff like that.
Wait, what do you mean? Like, supposed to? What happened? What?
Yeah, they're supposed, I mean, they had issues at one point where they had a huge caseload. They had like a lot of case managers quitting and stuff. So me specifically, I had like 6 months of the supportive services mm-hmm. I was supposed to receive from PATH. And I'm not trying to talk bad about them or anything. It's just literally what happened. And then after that, I got changed case managers and whatnot. And then that's when the supportive services from them kind of diminished. Like mm-hmm. they would stop coming over and like doing the case management as frequently as they would used to, or meeting me at SPY to like talk about budgeting and stuff like that. Like, they understand that you are formerly homeless, so you're not supposed to just throw a homeless person back into housing and expect it to work. You're supposed to support them. That's why it's called permanent supportive housing. So they just kind of dropped that aspect a little bit. So in terms of me like trying to move mm-hmm. and get out of this apartment before it got gentrified or had any big issues, they're supposed to help me do that, but they didn't help me in a timely manner. And then they only have like a 2-year span where they help you anyways, so they only helped me really for 6 months, and then at the last month and a half there was like not that much support, even if I tried to ask them for a lot of help.
So how are you being gentrified?
You're talking about in Inglewood? So the gentrification is taking place simply, like, the stadium, when I got there, it was basically on the ground. There was nothing there. So imagine I'm watching this thing being built, and as it got more and more built.
So the stadium, explain that though too. What stadium?
What, the Rams Stadium?
So the Rams, Los Angeles Rams.
Right, so there's the Forum, right? There's the Forum Stadium. Then to the right of that,
the Forum is where the Clippers used to play.
I don't know. I don't know basketball like that.
Way back in the day.
Just the Forum Stadium. They have fights there. They have concerts there. They have all sorts of events there, whether it's MMA, whether it's concerts, stuff like that. But yeah, the Forum Stadium, you Google it, you'll see it. But to the right of that is where they decided to build this giant Rams stadium, have all these cranes, have all this money invested there, like billions of dollars invested into this. And that's when I started to notice the gentrification, to answer Nathaniel's question, is like maybe a year into it. So a year into it, like, it wasn't that bad, you know, like everything's kind of chill. They're building it. Everything's kind of like the same price wise. And literally towards the end of that year, so like going into 2018, is where they were just like, OK, your $975 rent in your studio is about to go to $1,350. So it's like they did almost a $400 increase just because the stadium was starting to get built.
What?
Yes. So that's what I would say when the gentrification process started.
Yeah, pretty rapid. Yeah,
I mean, definitely. It's like you're paying more for actually living in a Because at the moment, it's being built, so it's kind of still messy, mm-hmm. noise everywhere and stuff like that. So that's interesting that they could even, in the right. process of building it, when everything is...
How many people live in your building?
So it's like a 60, like 50 unit type of apartment complex with only a few one bedrooms and a whole bunch of studios. But nah, man, when I first moved there, there would be like 4 to 5 people to one studio in some of those apartments. Uh-huh. But that's just because you could see the difficulty of the struggle. Like there's like a lot of families just trying to make it work in this one little studio. And then it sucks to say, but if you were to ask me following up into that, and I won't go into a deep rant about it, most of those families, guys, this is how powerful the gentrification is. There were 50 units, and all those units were filled to the point where there's little kids screaming and running outside everywhere. Now there are no kids. There's only 10 people living in the units. So there's like 10 units occupied out of the 50-something, whereas when I first moved there, there was over 50-something people occupying almost all the 60 units. Wow. So that's insane to me.
Wow. Was everyone in the building, were they all associated with PATH or with your connection, with the program that you were...
I mean, that apartment complex was known to take third-party assistance, like uh-huh. Section 8 uh-huh. or people assisting the homeless. So there was a variety of programs that were helping people live there. Some people were just living there out of their own expense, like they were definitely paying mm-hmm. their rent in full. But there were a lot of known like housing programs helping people sustain there.
That's crazy, though, for going from... So now it's partially occupied because most of the units have... increase the rent, so a lot of people have been displaced directly from that rent increase?
Essentially, so exactly like I was saying, first got there, everything was really low. Then a year later, that's when they tried to, I guess, sneak in that little gentrification. And because the Inglewood rent control at the time, guys, was not passed, yeah. they were basically legally allowed to do this because at the time, the way the law worked, because there's no rent control, the only thing they are obligated to do at the time is if it's a 10% increase or more, then they have to give you like a 60-day notice, and then you have 60 days to like get ready to start paying that increase. And if it was a 5% increase, then you have like 30-day notice. So that was the only real rent control to stop them from doing what they were doing. So imagine 2018 hit, beginning of the year fresh, they're like, hey, your rent's about to be $13.50, you have 60 days to start getting ready to do that.
Even 2 months, like that's a lot. Like I mean that's not a lot.
Yeah, it's, you know, not a
you
lot
need a little more time than that to find another job that will, you know, help you
accommodate all that. Yeah, yeah, that's a $400 increase that you're about to deal with per month.
And $1,400 for rent for a studio is a lot,
right? Right. I mean,
just period, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know, I want to take it to this real quick to kind of give you guys my quick insight on what I like to call like positive gentrification and negative gentrification. So this is an example of what I would like to consider negative gentrification in the realm of, like, see, everything has a good and a bad side, but gentrification doesn't always have to be bad. It's portrayed as bad in this scenario because why? You see, they're moving all these people out. You just heard, what is this? Is it Scott?
Yeah.
I don't want to, yeah. So you heard Scott just say that, you know, people are getting moved out and stuff. And it's bad because these people are doing these things but not taking care of the tenants. So you're going to make all the other surrounding apartments look nice or even make the stadium look nice. But the people who are currently living there, you don't want to pay them out to move them somewhere else. You don't want to at least pay to move them into one of the nicer apartments you just built. But instead, you would rather them sit in the apartment they currently live at with the same crappy conditions and then increase the rent $400. That is an example of negative gentrification because you are a community member living in the neighborhood. Now your rent increased $300, $400, and you have literally gained nothing.
Yeah, so a lot of people will choose to leave because why would you pay $400 more for the exact same thing?
Right.
Right? So that's kind of... So then a lot of people maybe self... I mean, even though they're being like, yeah, I don't know.
No, yeah, that is, oh yeah, cause, so that's basically the, I would say their goal of it is, like, these people are taking, and by these people, the people who have the money, they're taking advantage of, like, the legal system to the best of their ability, so it can frustrate you, so you can be uncomfortable, so that you, out of your own pocket, can invest time and money to moving yourself, so they don't have to.
So you're telling me they can just increase the price and not do anything else? Like, they don't have to.
Yeah, because without rent control, yeah.
Wow. So right. They don't even have to like renovate. They don't have to, you know.
And see, that's the part I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they have to, like, by like regular terms, like even if they are trying to like increase rent, or if they're trying to just, if you're trying to pay rent and there's a whole bunch of things broken,
to be an added value for you.
Right. There should be either a added value, or they should just fix these things with a timely manner for free.
For tenant rights.
And you can, you know, press your tenants' rights and kind of, they have like a 30-day window to where, let's say your sink was broken and you said, hey, my sink's broken, I want you to fix it. The day you sent the document, hey, I want my sink fixed, they have 30 days to fix that. Within 30 days, if they don't fix it, then you can start making legal actions if you're still paying rent. So let's say you paid rent, they still didn't fix the sink, it's been 30 days, now you can take legal action. But that's still 30 days of your time and you're still paying rent. And mind you, the rent has still gone up, which is why they like to play this game, because you're still having to do all the work. They're just sitting there.
And often when it comes to tenants versus, the people that hold the power to afford like legal teams and legal representation are often the property owners, right? And so that's the thing. Like, yeah, take legal action versus your landlord for not fixing your sink. That's going to take time and money, that there's often a misbalance and in who's got the time and money, right?
All right.
Yeah. And so then you often hear stories of like, well, I'd rather just move somewhere else where it actually, I can take the money that I do have and live in a place that's comfortable. It might be further out. It might be not in the neighborhood that I was in community with for a really long time. That's actually one of the things we see a lot more people in, like Angelino's moving outside of the city and farther away.
But even like suing your landlord is like suing your boss and going back and working there still. Like, so you're not going to want to sue them because at the end, you're just going to move.
If you still want to live there,
you're just going to move anyways. You're like, I don't want to live in the same place where I just sued this person. They're probably going to mistreat me.
Yeah, so it really often doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I think we see it more often with maybe kind of groups of tenants get together. Like if you guys have been following the Oakland Moms.
Or for example, in my scenario, because we're talking about you, most of the questions you guys have asked me is like all the early stage stuff. So if you really get into like the more current stuff, that's what's happening now. We're having community tenants meetings on what to do against our landlord and how to have a whole community conference. Like we're meeting there at McDonald's with like professional lawyers present.
Yeah, tell us how that started.
So that all started basically
it's a long process, several years.
So this place specifically where I live at the Inglewood Gardens is it's gotten so progressively bad with the whole gentrification as far as them trying to constantly increase the rent but then not fixing things, to where it started a whole community movement, because we have like tenants, like her name is Miss Dolores, downstairs with mold in her carpet and the ceiling is leaking and she has all these horrible things going on and she's an old lady and they don't want to move her into one of the new apartments they just renovated or pay her to move somewhere else, simply because they're on this whole gentrification thing trying to make money off her or to keep playing games. So that, because of things like that, and that's just one thing. So imagine we had a bed bug outbreak, we had like roach infestations at certain points. At one point there was 2 weeks of no hot water and I have all this documented and recorded and there's physical proof to prove it if anybody ever should deny it. But yeah, all those different things have happened, and you can only imagine these things are happening like in the wintertime. Imagine your kids, your grandma trying to take a bath and there's no hot water and it's 60, 50 degrees, bro, and it's early in the morning. You know what I'm saying? So it's like a lot of these public health issues started happening. We even contacted the Department of Public Health. They would just keep playing games, taking a long time to get there. So it became like this huge community thing where the whole community knows just how bad our apartment complex is. So it started a community movement now, and that's why we're having meetings and I'm in a lawsuit against them and all that.
Okay. Did PATH or any of the housing programs that you were working with, were they accessible or able to support in any of this or had any input?
I mean, we definitely foresaw that.
You were on your own lease, were you? No.
Yeah, I'm on my own lease.
Yeah, so it was like a rapid rehousing, so you signed an independent lease.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, cool.
So definitely own lease and stuff like that, but for like rapid rehousing or people assisting the homeless like PATH, for them, they were helping, and we foresaw, like, before it was getting bad to, like, the 2 weeks no hot water, before it was getting really bad, we had already foresaw, bro, we need to move because they're trying to increase the rent this much and it's not even worth it. So we definitely saw that we needed to move. It's just, again, the issues of LA and the landlords all wanting you to have, like, perfect credit. But if you're a young adult and you don't have perfect credit, you just have neutral credit, and they keep denying you. The rent most of the time was like $1,400, and me and my partner are both making $18 an hour each, so we both can clearly pay the rent. But just because our credit is neutral, they kept denying us, which made it hard for people assisting the homeless to help move us at the time. And eventually, they just took too long to help move us. And then our total program time with them, which was the 2-year marker, had ran out. Jeez. So they stopped helping us as a whole. So now it's just up to us.
That's not good.
So that's kind of like the best way I can answer that question.
No. Yeah. I mean, was there any maybe indicator when you were moving into the unit that that the landlords would have been not sympathetic to all these things, or like kind of, you know, I mean, they sound like slumlords in some
pretty
aspects.
Much. And it's funny that you say that, because a tenant got so upset that he made flyers saying that the landlord and the building owner were slumlords and then posted it on everyone's door. So you could tell there's a whole bunch of community movements at different times. And not to mention that this gentrification is so bad, and people don't want to deal with it so bad, that within the time span of me living there over the 2 years, I've had 4 different landlords and 4 different property managers. And you might be thinking in your head, well, dang, why did he have 4 different property managers? Because nobody wants to deal with actually fixing all the real problems of the building. They just want to get whatever money they're trying to gentrify off of it, get that higher rent increase money, move people out or whatever. But they don't want to fix the real problems. And every time we, the tenants, press on them, it's too much. They quit and they hurry up and sell it to the next person. That's probably why there's been 4 different building owners.
I mean, and now that you say that, like, now I'm starting to see maybe even how gentrification happens on the other end. You know, it's like they're reselling it to each other, all these buildings, and, you know, you just bought it and you bought it for, you know, maybe like $1 million more than the first person did. And so now you're like, okay, I got to make that up. How do I do that? Well, I got to increase the, you know, the price and the rent. So it's like, maybe they're not even intentionally trying to gentrify. It's just part of their business model to make profit, I guess.
And another thing, just so I can answer Robin's question real quick. You're kind of like saying like, oh, could I first scout out if the landlord was a slumlord or if the apartment place wasn't that great when I was first kind of scouting it out? But that's another thing. When you're homeless and you're getting offered an apartment, you don't get too picky. You just get what you get. Yeah, you're like, absolutely. I want to get off the street.
I think those are my questions. Are really thinking about, you know, we talk a lot about rapid rehousing being a program that is important in the spectrum of housing programs for ending homelessness, especially for, you know, maybe people like groups that aren't necessarily needing long-term permanent support, right? It's kind of like this transitional ish program. It's a couple of years. But yeah, there's a lot of support behind rapid rehousing as a model, right? To end the crisis of homelessness. But I think there's a lot of things, often there's some gaps and some holes, and you're not the first person that I've heard a story of someone moving into rapid rehousing where the conditions weren't great. Mm-hmm. And, or when the support was over, the person, like their ability to afford the rent there without the rental assistance was difficult. So people having to move elsewhere after the rental assistance, which, you know, like kind of defeats the ultimate goal of the model programmatically. So I'm just thinking from, you know, kind of a higher level homelessness services approach, you know, what can we do differently, or how can you prevent those things? And I think that's really important, this like concept of choice too. What you were saying, you don't get really picky and you lose choice sometimes.
And there's such a high turnover, right? Trevion, you were mentioning like the caseworkers, right? And with PATH, and it's not just with PATH. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty much across the board with organizations. I've experienced that in my experience of homelessness. Mm-hmm. And just kind of acknowledging that like the system, a few episodes ago, someone said the system, I think it was Martel, said the system is functioning the way it was designed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But at the same time, like I really believe that a lot of these people go into the homeless services industry because they want to make a difference, but then they get caught up in this bureaucracy. They get frustrated and they give up. It doesn't pay well. It's hard work. There's all these like gaps that aren't being addressed right. And so it gets, I think, frustrating for people that really, really want to actually, like, we have someone in the background nodding because it's true. And it's just interesting to me. And the other thing too, that I felt like is so important is, one of the resources that you sent us yesterday, Robin, to research this episode was talking about how folks that identify as Black or African American, the population in Los Angeles County has gone from 10% to 9%. And it's going down. And it's going down because gentrification, because Inglewood was a middle class Black community, right? And is a middle class Black community, right? It's not a poor community. And there's something, there's a, for the size of the community, the home ownership level is also really high, right? Yep. And so that was really interesting to me to kind of learn all of that, that it's looking different than when we're looking at other neighborhoods and just where are these people just moving? No, a lot of people are actually leaving Southern California because they can't afford to stay here and their families have been here for generations.
We're losing Angelenos at like a rapid rate currently because of this. And I think, like, I don't know, I have a couple of different thoughts thinking back to rapid rehousing as a model of like how key the landlord and the property owners are to make that model a success and how we'll need to scale that. But we need, I don't think that's something we can just expect landlords and property owners to, you know, jump in line to be a part of that model. Like you're saying, like they have their own business model, et cetera. They're just kind of playing the game that's been presented to them. But, and that's where we need some policy action in that they did implement rent control, but it was like a little too late, a lot too late.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's been talks of just permanent rent freeze across the city. I guess New York had a rent freeze for a long period of time. And Los Angeles is totally capable of doing that, just stopping rent increases for, you know, overall, just permanently, well, not permanently, temporarily.
Right. And I mean, stuff like that should definitely have happened already. Tenants rates. It should have happened 5 years ago.
Yeah,
that type of stuff should have happened so long ago. Like rent control got passed. For me this year in January when it would have been helpful literally 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Like two and a half years. So that's another thing too. Like this is again what I'm trying to say. Like everything is not always bad. Like people give gentrification such a bad name and I'm a person who's directly suffering from it or experiencing things from it. And I don't even look at it as a totally bad thing, but it's like, see, you need to cover both sides. Like if you're going to gentrify it, then that's fine. But you need to like you said, free, you know, like, rent control should have been established before you allowed them to start gentrifying. So if you're like, dang, they have this plan to build this high stadium and it's going to increase rent by like $400. Let's pass the rent control before we let them build the stadium. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's fine. That with that being said and done, now gentrification's fine because they still get to build their fancy stadium. We still get to live there.
Or have places where they can go live. Like there isn't any affordable part of town anymore. Like it's just every
there's no protections on affordable
gentrified.
We're not building or maintaining affordable housing at the rate that we should be. The housing, I mean, the other thing too, I keep thinking about, one thing that's just been learning more about is the so people are, as people get displaced, they're moving further and further out, but the jobs still remain in the city. And some of the reasons that's driving, I don't know if you're aware, something I'm hyper like thinking about all the time is Los Angeles has the worst air quality of any city in the country. And obviously the traffic is really bad. So how even driving up housing costs, not protecting rent, like directly impacts the way that we, our health and our, and the quality of the city is just, that's getting worse and worse and no one's making active. No one really cares about that or isn't putting any policies down on paper.
Apparently has over 3,000 apartment units. Mayor Butts was talking about that in one of the episodes that I was listening to. So the stadium's going to have like over 3,000 rental units within the complex and a huge like movie theater and all of this. So it's like they're adding on housing. So it's like what doesn't make sense to me.
It's just clear that the developers and local city leaders, they just want to make cash. and profit off this and aren't taking any consideration into supporting the residents that have lived there for a long time, the history of the city, the culture of the city, and yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know right now in Ethiopia, actually, I've been following up a lot on articles and news about what's going on over there. And, you know, the capital is, you know, constantly changing. And, you know, it's becoming more, I guess, like it's going from a lower income third world country to now, you know, moving up to middle income. And so as they're trying to do that, you know, they say, okay, we want to beautify the city, you know, make sure the city looks beautiful and all that to attract investors, tourists, and different things like that, which makes sense. You know, it's beneficial for the city. And, but the thing is, what they said was, okay, when we are tearing down all these different places where people live, like when they're building apartment buildings, they're actually giving them a, like an actual spot. So it's like, they're not just like throwing you away, like, oh, here's some money, give us your land or whatever. It's like, we're actually giving you a place where you can go and some additional income.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like just like different solutions that other places there, are doing.
There are solutions, you know, and I don't know. All of them, or, you know, I'm not an expert on preventing, I'm not an urban planner. But I think, you know, we keep getting back to a lot of the purpose of this podcast is to bring stories and light and experience into these issues. But then I think we always come back to, yeah, our local leadership is failing us and how, you know, if we really care about ending homelessness and supporting the young people and the members that go to SPY, we really need to be active on these bigger issues, right? Like to think that it's a bummer that we weren't like, oh, this stadium coming in and this new football team. I mean, that's the one thing too, like Los Angeles, we didn't have any football teams. Now we have several and we have all these things.
Yeah,
and
that's,
like, that's, did we not,
two new teams now.
Yeah. Did we not think about how that would have a trickle down effect to the direct impact on the work that we're doing here in this space,
like,
right?
I would love to see if they can find, like, if they can find a way to calculate how many homeless people are created from this gentrification process of Inglewood.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that, I don't know.
So what do you think what would you suggest are some solutions, and tell us about what's going on? No.
Well, definitely like some solutions.
I want to hear more about the tenant, your community group, and how you guys connected and what's going on.
Well, we connected because a community engagement coordinator from like Long Beach, and also a lawyer, like law firm from Long Beach that specializes in tenant versus like landlord cases came through. And that's when they kind of like proposed to us like, hey, we found out about you guys through all the stuff that's going on in your community, and then they're just saying like how they want to make sure that we know our tenants' rights and stuff, and how that's like, I think they're like LA Voice or something, I don't know, I need to get their information and stuff like that, but they wanted to make sure that we knew our rights and that we knew that what these people were doing weren't right, and how we can make a community standpoint, because there's the whole stadium and stuff, and how this could be a big thing about gentrification and stuff like that. So that's kind of how it first started.
Do you think that was a successful or a good
It's kind of weird
process, or how? Yeah,
it's successful in the terms of like us getting together to probably sue them and like get money back for like the physical and psychological damages that have been occurred from us just living there, like not having hot water for 2 weeks and bed bugs biting on you and stuff like that. And like, so all those things, like that stuff is like definitely being taken care of. There's a solution for that. But as far as like us getting together as a community to literally make a community letter to send to the landlord, like, hey, these are the things you need to fix, and these are the things that are going wrong, and then the landlord responding back to it. That was kind of weird, because he responded back in a weird way, trying to like deny everything and like sneakily say, oh, I am trying to make these changes, but in reality, you're not. So it's just like,
have you met him? Does he come around in person?
We've met him in person a few times. It's like a dad and his son in their own like family business type of thing. And I mean, they're okay, but it's like they definitely are just trying to like probably get their money or whatever. Like they're trying to like fix it up, but they're not doing it at a like reasonable rate. Like you guys are still like, for example, just last night, my water got turned off. I came home, tried to turn on my faucet. There's no water. Where's the note on my door that says, hey, we're about to turn the water off? Or where's the text message that says that, or any of these things? But then these people at the same time will text you and be like, hey, man, you have illegal late fees, though. And I say illegal because they can't even charge the late fees, but they're trying to give you the late fees because they feel like your rent is late. But my rent is late because everything is late because I don't got no water. How am I supposed to shower myself to do? You know what I'm saying? So this is the problem with it. And those are some of the solutions as a community we came up with, is like writing them letters and seeing like how that can go to push them. So it makes it more accountable. So if we do go to court, it's like, well, they got a whole community letter on what is broken and what needs to be fixed. And if they didn't attend to it, that's on them as landlords. And when it goes up to the courts and there's all this money on the line, they're not going to have really much to say. So in those terms, there's a lot of progress being made. But as a community standpoint, to kind of get the landlord to listen to our needs and like there be like a positive resolution where we're all shaking hands, that didn't really happen. So yeah. And then for me specifically, I'm in a like mentality of like, oh, well, because I'm moving myself to Vegas. And like you just said, all these people are having to move out of just like not just their apartment to a new apartment, but to a whole new locations.
Yeah. Tell us about the process of what made you decide that you were ready to leave.
So what made me decide that I'm ready to leave is the fact that, like I said, the rent control is too little too late. You guys are going to finally pass that countywide now, but barely in 2020, acting like that was something really hard for them to do when it really wasn't. And then it kind of goes back into the credit thing.
But your rent control doesn't matter if your rent's already been increased.
Right, exactly. And then it goes to the credit thing, because I've talked about this to so many people, bro. Like, even if I was homeless, even if I wasn't homeless, and I'm on my game, and I have everything together, and I make four times the rent, and I do all these amazing things, it doesn't matter, and I can get denied time after time just because my credit doesn't match what this landlord wants me to match. And then I'm getting charged, like, application fees and background fees of $35 each time just to figure that out or whatever. And that's what makes it tedious. So it's like, I'm not about to go through that whole process while using a whole nonprofit that specializes in help housing people, and they can't even help me either to find a new apartment. And I've been doing that for 2 years now by myself without the help of Path, because they, you know, even with them, failed to help me do so. So it's like, if two different nonprofits are trying to help me move and I still can't move, and I'm making like triple, quadruple the rent, and the landlords are still playing games, not taking me just because they can, and that's just fun for them, because we all don't have credit because our parents didn't buy us a credit card when we were 16 and let us start building credit. Bro, I'm sorry, we don't all have that. So, you know what I'm saying? That's why people have to go. Like, that's why I have to move. And the only solution out of all that is to move to what I call the outskirts. But at that point, you're hurting yourself in terms of your social realm. Like Nathaniel said, you're destroying your identity in that point. Like, okay, cool, everything's so expensive, let me move to the valley where rent's only $500, $600 in the valley. But great, now I'm in the valley 20 miles away from all my regular work opportunities, all my friends and family. And not to mind you guys, hey, if you don't have a car, none of that's possible anyways, because how am I going to get out there to build up my life to then get a car to then drive back over here and do work over here, because there ain't that much work over there? So it's just like a huge loophole they're trying to play, or like loop, like there's all these like random loopholes that make it hard. And once you start becoming aware of all these things and running into all these different walls, that's when you come to the conclusion of like, all right, bro, maybe I do need to move somewhere else. And it's crazy because all this gentrification, all this stuff is happening because we look at it like, oh, look at the sky and look at the beach, it's so enjoyable, and that's why you should be paying this much and suffering this much. And it's like, bro, I'm not enjoying the weather that much, and I'm not enjoying the beach that much. So why not go to Vegas, where there's all the same stuff, all the same entertainment, all the same things going on, but they have $500 one bedrooms, one baths, and then there's just as much job opportunities. Like, so that, you know, that's kind of like the reason why. And I notice it's not just me. Like you said, there are tons of people moving to Vegas and other surrounding like states and stuff like that, because they're getting the same thing. They're stressing way less. And then it's the same. Yeah, it's just a lot. And it's hopefully, I pray that people have family. That's why I'm allowed and blessed to do it without having super stress. But yeah, that's kind of like the point of it, man. That's the gist of it. And until stuff like that changes, or until they make it easier for people, that's what's just going to keep happening. Like, thank God for the rent control being passed now. But like, y'all need to start giving Section 8 to more people and approving that faster in different areas. Like I've said it before, start advertising the other cities. Like if you feel like LA is crowded and clogged and you as a city don't want people here, it's already rich and you want your rich people living there, that's fine, great. Okay, how about the DPSS? What if Department of Social Services whipped out a sign and said, hey, you guys are struggling to live here. What if I moved you to the Valley in a Section 8 apartment and all you have to do is pay $200 in rent, but Section 8 got you covered for X amount of years. And this is all happening because the government wants to promote it because too many people live here and we're trying to influence people to live in other cities and build up other cities. People would probably jump on that. They would be like, damn, you know what? I'm homeless, but at least they're going to house me somewhere and the rent's still going to be cheap and I can still get back on my feet even if it is away. The reason why it's intimidating is because what I told you guys earlier, you're going to have to move to the Valley without any support, without any Section 8, without anything, without no friends, without nothing, and then you're trying to make it all happen. There are cheap areas to live, but then it's too intimidating because, like Nathaniel said, your identity gets destroyed because there's nothing there.
Taking people out of their community.
Or you're taking them out of their community, right. And then there's no fail-safe. Like, okay, guys, at least if I'm going to strip you from your community, your friends and all that, at least I can make the rent dirt cheap for you. No, they can't even do that. So that's definitely the problem why I feel like people are moving out of here, because even if you play the game of, okay, I'm about to move somewhere else and be on my grind, it's still hard. Even if you play the game of, okay, I'm going to try and build my credit and do all this, it's still hard. Even if you go to school and work and do all this, that's what I'm saying, bro. They make it impossible. I'm what I like to call like next level homeless. I'm the type of homeless person where you see me wake up, zip my tent up at 6 a.m., put it away, go to work, and then I'm laying down in my tent with blankets watching Netflix. How is that possible if you're homeless? How? Because it's strategic. It's smart. I still pay my bills. I still get up and wake up and handle my responsibilities. And that's what I'm trying to say. I'm going to end the rant right there, is that even if you're on your P's and Q's and you're handling your responsibilities, it's still nearly impossible to make these things happen. Everybody you hear who said they made it have a miracle story.
Yeah.
So, oh yeah, someone helped me do it. Oh, me and my partner. Oh yeah, it's always this miracle story. But yeah, that's it, guys.
Well, wow.
But that's a real thing though, too, right? Like there's a meme that I recently saw that was, it's like a Twitter, someone's Twitter post or something that someone turned into a meme, and it was talking about that these heartwarming stories that we hear, right, are oftentimes like this myth of exceptionalism, like we want to highlight. And I see there's a nonprofit here on the West Side. I won't name them out because we've already mentioned PATH a whole bunch of times, but this nonprofit is really famous for that. They love to highlight these like few individual stories of like exceptionalism while all these other people are floundering. And it's really frustrating to me because I left LA in 2011, went back to Oregon for about 6.5-7 years, and came back in 2017. And I thought, oh, LA's gentrifying so quick, I can't really afford it here. I want to go back to Oregon where I'm from. Portland and in my hometown in Southern Oregon, completely gentrified. My hometown, 6,000 people. All of the, there's 4 subsidized low-income housing, like big housing complexes, like apartment buildings. But like all of the other housing is all being bought up by people that come in from out of town, go, oh, this is really beautiful. Look at the beach. It's really nice weather in this little spot. And they turn them into vacation rentals and won't rent them out to people. And it's like they're buying like the worst properties in the town, flipping them and turning, and then only renting them out for like a week at a time or whatever to people that are traveling through on the 101. So all these people that have lived there for generations that were fisher people and loggers and things like that can't afford to live there anymore. And that's in my hometown, right? So it's happening here, but it's happening in so many places. Yeah. I guarantee you it's probably happening in Vegas just on a different rate.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say, Trevion, you sharing your story, and thank you so much for going on rants and being really open and honest about all of your experience. I think this is going to be really important part of, hopefully part of the solution. I don't, you know, I'm not going to say it is the solution. It's not there. We need like big level change, but we're really grateful for you. But I also wanted to, can you tell us, just highlight what a cool person you are in general. And can you share to us the book that you have here?
What book? This Materia Medica that Trevion's, I just found on the floor yesterday.
You know, I'm going to speak from, you know, being able to work with you for over the past couple of years, you have really unique skill set and set of interests, and it's been a really important part of SPY and kind of the stuff that you brought into this programming. And yeah, tell us about your book.
Oh,
and
this,
what else you do here?
This book, well, it's not mine. I just found it, but it's a book about herbal medicine and stuff. But that could be like a segue into it, who I am. Like that's kind of like who I am in a sense, is I am just a person where I like to teach and show people all the natural and organic and original ways that we as human beings can heal, thrive, or empower ourselves. I tell people this all the time. How do you think in the 1700s and 1600s you have like these soldiers marching from city to city fighting each other 300 miles away and then marching back home without all this medical technology and stuff we have now? How are they doing that and still coming home alive, bro? Like, how did you just march 200 miles somewhere, fight, and then come back and you're still good? Like, that had to have been all natural and organic ways, again, how they empowered themselves, fed themselves, or healed themselves. So I'm just trying to show people back to the original roots what is possible. So teaching people, for example, grains like amaranth are better than grains like spinach because they do the same thing, except
what
they have...
What about moringa?
Or even
how
like,
do you feel about moringa?
Or even like moringa. So you go ask, trigger
the famous moringa.
Trigger the moringa. Like, we on the West over here are barely getting used to moringa. But essentially, it's called the tree of life in many countries because it's one tree that can grow to the full size of its maximum in a year if you take care of it. So it grows really fast, can survive desert climates and even winter climates if you take care of it. Produces these leaves that have like damn near 7 to 8 times the vitamins and minerals and nutrients of everything. So it's like, if it's anti-inflammatory, vitamin A through Z, doesn't matter. This thing has all of it, and it's
the number one like sponsor of, or you're sponsored by moringa basically, but
no,
we love it. I'm really grateful for you just in general, but then
thank you Travion. Appreciate it.
I'm hoping good things in Vegas.
I know.
And I think you'll keep us in touch. And I told you, I got a pal out there that you can hang out with.
Yeah. If you see a forest spawn out of nowhere, that's me.
What are you looking forward to most about going to Vegas?
I'm looking forward to just going there and proving to people that you can make a food forest out of any basically landscape that we've already inhabited. So if humans live there, definitely like food forests can be established there. So I'm going to basically... Like I said, if you see a food forest pop out of nowhere and there's all this lush greenery in Vegas, that's probably me.
Yeah.
It's
Trevion. Well, we'll look forward, and we'll look forward to you taking my path out there and being our ambassador in Vegas with Nick out there. So that's really exciting.
That's so cool.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and that's going to be great. But also we'll miss you, but...
Luckily, it's only a 40-minute flight.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for this again.
Oh, thank you guys.
All right.
Thank you.
Any final thoughts? Do you have any final wisdom for the Dogtown listeners?
Yeah, man. So just, I know it's been like a long podcast. It's been on gentrification and stuff, but just overall, we just need to get more community inclusion. Like, we always rely on the government and stuff to kind of do things. But if we as communities band together, just like how we're making this podcast, just like how we have a community garden over here, and we feed the homeless and feed each other off of our community power, and we put, a lot of community, we need more of that everywhere we go. So just everybody get empowered to build your communities up, teach each other, invest time on making YouTube videos, teaching each other. Don't limit yourself. Use the internet. If you got Google or YouTube, teach yourself whatever you want to teach yourself. Is all out there, and that's all I really have to say. Because that's another thing. That's the last thing I'm gonna say. The government likes to pretend that there are no answers to things, or pretend that the answers are out there, but it's your job to go find them. So trust me, all the knowledge you're looking for is out there, but just go find it on your own. They like to tell you it's not real or it doesn't exist. It's real. It does exist. You just have to go look for it.
All right.
So go look for it.
Go look for it. Goodbye, Dogtown. Okay. Signing off.
This podcast is produced by LensCo in partnership with Safe Place for Youth and funded by the Department of Mental Health Innovations 2.